came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. His disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. It was about the sixth hour when a woman from Samaria came to draw water.
"Give me a drink."
"How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?"
She was surprised, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans.
"If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water."
"Sir, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock."
"Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life."
"Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water."
"Go, call your husband and come here."
"I have no husband."
"You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true."
"Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship."
"Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is now here, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth."
"I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things."
"I who speak to you am he."
Just then his disciples came back. They marvelled that he was talking with a woman, but no one said to her, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" So the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and spoke to the people.
"Come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?"
They went out of the town and were coming to him. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging Jesus, saying, "Rabbi, eat."
"I have food to eat that you know nothing about."
So the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him something to eat?"
"My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say, 'There are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest'? Look, I tell you to lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, 'One sows and another reaps.' I sent you to reap that for which you did not labour. Others have laboured and you have entered into their labour."
Many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony, "He told me all that I ever did." So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. They said to the woman, "It's no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Saviour of the world." What do you like in that story? What do you like in that encounter between Jesus and that woman? What kind of stands out to you as, I love that? Anybody? Anybody?
No judgment.
No judgment, yeah. She's kind of looking for it all the time, isn't she? But it's not there. Anything?
And he sees her?
Yeah, he sees her, doesn't he? Yeah.
When she realises that, that makes her enthusiastic to go and tell others?
Yeah. Yeah, he does. For me, this story's always sort of moved me deeply, this story. And I've often wondered why that is. I've often thought this would be the passage I'd like preached on when I'm buried. And I'm not sure why it appeals to me so much. One thing about my life is that when we were little, we moved a lot, didn't we? We came to Australia from Africa when I was 4, and we lived up and down and up again the coast of WA until my high school years. Then we went to Hamilton in Victoria and lived in a couple of houses there and went to just the one school. And then in my last year of school, Mum and Dad came to Adelaide and I stayed and finished at boarding school and then went to Melbourne after that and then ended up in Adelaide. So I've kind of, in a way, I think growing up, I always felt like I was a bit of the outsider, never the local, that was true. I was never the local. And it was just strange. I think I went to 5 primary schools. So Liz is so different to me. Liz, all her life, grew up in one house that her dad built for his wife and put the front door on the day they were married. And then she went and governessed for her first year after high school, and then she came into Adelaide and she lived in North Adelaide, and then she married me, and then we started moving around. We moved quite a bit in the early years of our marriage. And so Liz could remember and still knows people she went to kindergarten with and primary school. I can't remember the names of people at high school. You know, it's just sort of everything's moved on. And so I think there's something about that in this story, about belonging. I think every one of us wants to know that we belong somewhere, that we are valued in a community, and that we matter. If we weren't there, it would mean something. I think that really is a very deep thing in us. I want to talk about that. So 3 times in the gospel reading, we find the Samaritan raising questions with Jesus about which group he belongs to. The very first happens very early on in their conversation. He's there, she's come together to draw water, and he says, "Can you give me a drink?" That's a very generous kind of offer. I've been listening to some lectures on evangelism in a sceptical world, evangelism in our postmodern world, and the speaker is a really engaging Chinese-Australian guy from Sydney. And he's got the most broad Australian accent on Audible I've ever heard. It's fantastic. It's so ochre Australian accent. And he says that in our Western, sort of more privatised and secularised world, we don't see in the scriptures how important hospitality is. Hospitality is a really important part of being the Christian community in the New Testament. And he says that, and he's talking about how we love to invite our non-Christian friends to some Christian things. But he said the first thing we've got to do is we've got to go to where they go. We've got to go with them to their things. You know, it's, otherwise the suspicion is, okay, so you're trying to get me in a corner. But it's kind of polite, isn't it? Someone invites you to your place and you, someone invites you to their place and you go, and then you can invite them to your place, and it's kind of natural. It's part of friendship and belonging. Anyway, Jesus has asked for this water, but she puts a roadblock in the way straight away. She draws a line in the sand, and she's inviting Jesus to put his finger in that line as well. She says, how come you, a Jew, ask me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? So there's kind of two groups that she's saying, you don't belong here in. You're Jewish, I'm Samaritan. Implied you're a man, doesn't say it explicitly. It does say I'm a woman. And clearly in her world, those groups don't mix. They don't fraternise. So that's the first one in verse 9. How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? A little bit later, well, Jesus answers that and says, well, look, if you knew who was asking you for a drink, you'd ask him for one, because he'd give you living water. And then she raises the roadblock again. What, are you better than Jacob, is her question. She's drawn another line. So you're saying that you do better than us Samaritans. This well, you know, you Jews, you think you're so much better than us, but you know, this well we had from Jacob, who was Isaac's son, who was Abraham's son, we're just as good as you, and you're better than us. And then a little later on, the conversation goes again, and in the interim, there's been a little bit of softening, but he says to her, he's had that conversation with her about her marriages. And he's known all about her without knowing her. He's perceived her, he's seen her, like you said, without judgment. But she raises a kind of a roadblock question again. She says, well, where's the right place to worship? We know you Jews worship in Jerusalem, but we worship here on this mountain. What's the right place? So three times she's kind of put these lines in the sand and in a way invited Jesus to join her in putting those lines in the sand. She could have come across as abrupt or aggressive or cranky, I reckon, especially early on in those conversations. Jesus keeps trying, though, doesn't he? He keeps opening the door. He doesn't join her in drawing that line in the sand. Our world is a lot like that at the moment. So many conversations we have, people are putting a line in the sand and asking what side of the line we're on. We're a polarised world at the moment. Here's an oldie. Do you support the Crows or Port? That's it. Oh, I'm out of here. Do you vote blue or red or green or teal or orange or purple? That's generally not spelled out in the colours, although two are used, but that's a line in the sand kind of question, isn't it? And we, in our world, people are closeting themselves in like-minded communities. A really interesting fact from American survey of all the counties, that all the vote of all the counties in recent presidential elections. So at the time of Reagan, about 20% of counties would have been more than 60-40 for one party or the other. So only 20% were kind of out there. The rest were much more middle ground. Now it's over 80% of counties are more one-sided in their politics. So part of the difficulty in America is that many people have a view of others who they never meet. They're just not in their world, politically anyway. There's an interesting fact. Maybe we get it, maybe not so much in politics, but on social issues. Are you progressive or conservative? Are you from here or are you from somewhere else? That was a question I felt a lot as a kid. When we arrived from Africa, I didn't know I had an accent. I just spoke the way people speak. But everybody could tell I wasn't from here. And I wasn't from here. You're not from here. I think it's less of an issue in cities than, but certainly in rural communities, it's still that way a bit. A friend of mine who lived on Kangaroo Island said, you become a local there when you're buried in the cemetery and you can't go away. So either you're born there or you're buried there. That's the only two ways to be a local. Churches, are you Protestant or Catholic or Orthodox? They're line in the sands questions often, aren't they? Are you evangelical or liberal? Are you charismatic or conservative? Which side of the line are you on? Because that'll determine how I relate to you. Because that's what happens. The answers to these questions are the basis then for whether the one who is asking these things thinks they can relate to you, or whether they'll just walk away and not engage with you, exclude you in some way. I think it's becoming worse in our world. I think the febrile, heated environment of social media has made these things much more divisive than they ever were. I mean, they've always been somewhat divisive. Certainly the Catholic-Protestant thing, that's not a new thing, is it? You know, I talked to people who grew up in the 50s and it was very much, you know, one or the other. Anthropologists distinguish between three basic kinds of cultures. There's what they call a guilt righteousness culture. There's a shame honour culture. And there's a fear freedom culture. They're the kind of three basic cultures. And those paired words often, that they say that the first word, like the guilt or the shame or the fear, are ways in which controls are put on the behaviours of people, and that the others are seen as the virtues of to be pursued. I don't want to talk too much about it, but I do want to talk about shame cultures. Just by the way, fear cultures is kind of more the pagan kind of world where there are spiritual powers. In a way, these cultures are all defined with who do you negotiate with to have a good life. So in a fear culture, you're negotiating with spirits and gods who maybe are hostile to you in some way, so you negotiate through magic and rituals and so on. A guilt culture, you're actually negotiating either with God or with yourself, or with this kind of law, the right thing to do. So you're sort of negotiating with that. But in a shame culture, what you're negotiating with is the group you belong to. So you're kind of working, how do I fit in here? So that's the thing about a shame culture. It's about fitting in and belonging to the group. Really big values in shame cultures are not about doing the right thing. That's not that. That's a value. Like, I don't think any of the cultures are this only. I think there's elements of all of these, but it's kind of like the dominant note of a culture. In a shame culture, it's not so much that you do the right thing, but that you don't break the social norms. So in our culture, someone could say, and we'd think of them as somewhat heroic, I don't care what everybody else is doing, I'm going to do the right thing. But in a shame culture, that doesn't make any sense. The right thing is doing what everybody does. It's fitting in with what people, the way people are. It's a really bad thing in a shame honour culture to bring shame on somebody. So if you misbehave as a kid and get in trouble with the law, the big problem isn't that you've got in trouble with the law. The big problem is that you've brought shame on your parents by what you've done. You've given them some disgrace in the community by what you've done. Anybody ever seen the movie Quiz Show? It's got Ralph Fiennes, and it's a fantastic movie. It's such an interesting movie. It's based on a true story about a guy whose surname was Van Buren, and he went on an American quiz show. He was the quintessential American good guy. Like, he was blonde, he had a good jaw, and he was brainy, and he was lecturing at uni. He was an American success story, and he went on this show. And you know what the real purpose of all TV shows is? To generate income. That's what the purpose of all... So advertising is... And the advertisers loved this guy, so they wanted him to stay. And so the producers offered to feed him the answers to the questions beforehand so he couldn't be beat. And foolishly, he went along with it. And then the guy that he beat, who'd also been fed questions, he was now annoyed that he wasn't the hero anymore. He got beaten and he left. And so he contacted a journalist and broke the story. And now, a name like Van Buren in America, you're likely to be known, particularly if you've got some prominence. His dad was a very prominent person. And there's this scene, once it's become public in the paper, the boy goes to his dad and he says, "Dad, don't worry about this. I'll wear it. I'll take the blame." So he's thinking of it in terms of guilt righteousness thing. And the dad says to him, but your name is my name. He's thinking in terms of honour and shame. Well, this woman is mostly, the thing that would typify the New Testament culture is mostly a shame culture. And so for her to be excluded from the group would be almost as bad as being dead. And sadly for her, she didn't belong. We get a couple of clues about that. The text doesn't say it explicitly. But we know at the beginning of the reading, she's going out to draw water when Jesus is there. And we know that it was now the sixth hour. And the sixth hour in New Testament time is midday. So 6 a.m. is the start of the day. The sixth hour is midday. 6 p.m. is the end of the day. And she's gone there in the middle of the day. Well, normally in her culture, if you're going to draw water, you're drawing water for the daily needs of the family. That's what the women would go to the well for. They go out of the town, go to the well, draw their water while it's still cool and when the water's going to be needed for the whole day, and take it back. And she's gone in the middle of the day when it's hot, and when half the day is gone, when people are going to be wanting water. She doesn't want to be around when the women are around. Or they've told her, "We don't want you around when we're around." She knows herself to be excluded. And the reason for that could be what Jesus raises with her about her serial marriage failures. He says, go and get your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. And I love the way Jesus deals with that's a kind of a, in a way, she can't actually say because it's a shame to talk about it. And Jesus says, no, that's true. You have had five husbands, and the man you live with now isn't your husband. So, yes, what you said was true. You don't have a husband. But he's kind of just brought out this thing that may have been shameful for her. And yet he's done it in such a way that there's no judgment in it. In fact, he's honoured her by saying, yes, that's true. You spoke the truth. He's kind of not shamed her with those words. It's quite interesting, isn't it? So why would you be married five times? I don't ask that cynically. Well, you've either been widowed five times, or you've been divorced five times, or a mix of the two. If you knew somebody who'd been widowed five times, what would be going through your mind?
Is she poisoning them?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Maybe and that may have been partly what would be going through the minds of the women in the town. Maybe, though, also, in particularly in this culture, you might think maybe there's something spiritually wrong with her. People have contact with her and they die. Maybe there's something demonic about her. Could have been that. What about, what would you think? It's a hard, dumb question in a way. But if you met someone who'd been divorced five times, now in her culture, very rarely it would have been her choice. Men could divorce women quite easily. So why have you had five husbands who've given you the flick? There'd be all kinds of, you know, questions about that. Could be sexual impropriety. It could be that you're a hopeless cook. Could be that you're just... That was one of the reasons you could divorce a wife in one of the schools of divorce law. You know, there were kinds of different approaches. You could have been just an impossible woman to live with. Pardon?
Or maybe not having babies.
Maybe not having babies, yeah. There's all kind, and all of those things in her culture would have been shame markers. You know, so she is a woman who's immersed in shame.
She still wants to have some appeal with him she was married for.
That's right. There must have been something, but now she's with a guy who hasn't married her, and she certainly thinks there's something appealing about marriage, though, or relationships anyway, doesn't she? So here's the thing, though. She's excluded and excluded and excluded. And then Jesus rocks up and he asks her a question. And what does she try to do to him? Put up a barrier. My guess is she's so cranky, so obstructive to this conversation going anywhere, as she is at the beginning, because she doesn't want to get hurt again. She'll draw the line and let him draw the line. We can walk away and that'll be it. I think we meet a lot of people like that in our world, don't we? People who are sort of abrasive, and it's very hard to get close to them. But you know what's going on with someone who's abrasive and very hard to get close to is they're really longing that someone could get close to them. That's why she keeps going back to marriage. She's essentially thirsty. She's longing for something. So when Jesus asks her for a drink, she's a bit shocked. All the social norms say, nope, don't do that, but he's gone ahead and done it. Jesus' approach to her, his constant approach to her, really opens up for her new possibilities. He never draws the line in the sand. What are some of the deal breakers, like the roadblocks, that people might put in the way of you if you were ever to start to talk about spiritual things? Things that say, we're not having this conversation. Things that kind of, they're kind of like the deal breakers. This Sam,
are you talking about spirituality itself, or are you talking about the issues that we might find face as Christians?
Well, I think if we're trying to talk about faith, people will raise the issues. I think that's what happens. We try to talk about faith and people say, I can't believe in a God who's homophobic.
Yes.
Or I can't believe in a God who allows women to be so mistreated. Those kind of, they're the kind of, or God who's so legalistic, a God who, you know, all the issues that come our way. What Jesus does as she keeps putting these roadblocks in the way is he ignores the issue. He just keeps talking about the thing, the big thing, which is, I can satisfy your thirst. I know something that will satisfy your thirst. But he leads her through this conversation and he leads her in a way to discover what her thirst is. And so when he talks about her marriage failures, she says, I see you're a prophet. So she's thinking, he's got something, this guy. And so she asks a question about where do you worship? And, you know, she's actually gone down the right track at last. because thirstiness and worship so belong together. That psalm I read at the start, oh God, you are my God, eagerly I long for you, I thirst for you as a dry and weary land where there is no water. And that's the man who knows God. All her life, this woman has looked to belong, to be valued, to be thought important, and to be worth something. That's what she's longed for, that someone would relate to her that way. And that's what led her down the track of relationship after relationship. And maybe being like that did make her difficult to live with. You know, that thirstiness that no person could ever really satisfy. Maybe, but maybe not too. She wants someone, though, who will recognise and honour her. And that's, in a way, what Jesus is doing, isn't it? He's recognised her and he's honoured her in this conversation. That's true. And he's had a completely non-patronising conversation with her. Beneath this longing for someone is an even deeper longing and need, one that every person has. And that woman somehow gets there when she moves the question from marriage to worship. Jesus tells her, so is it Jews or Samaritans? She's raised the roadblock again. Jesus says, look, that's going to be irrelevant. The day is coming and it's here now when the Father is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Whatever religious background she has, there's a promise of God that she can come to know him as Father and worship him. That's the deepest longing and the deepest thirst in every soul. Because when we worship God, when we behold his beauty, when we see his glory, and what we see there is the God who is gracious and merciful and who moves to us with all kindness and goodness and gift and blessing. We are made for God. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee, said St. Augustine. You could say that our hearts strive and search and thirst until they find their satisfaction in knowing him. But even then, you know, knowing God, we never stop thirsting for him. We keep desiring him. Jesus has come, the only Son from the bosom of the Father, and he has made this God known to us. That's the wonderful truth about the grace of God in Jesus Christ. He meets us in our shame and our guilt without condemnation and tells us of a grace that is for all who believe in him. That's all you need to do. Trust me. It's a grace that satisfies all our longings. A grace that bears away and washes away all of our guilt and all of our shame. A grace that makes a new start possible for us. A grace that tells us that in Jesus we are welcomed and included and valued and loved by God. A grace that makes us as welcome and included and valued and loved by God as the Father's Son is. A grace by which we know we belong within the community of God and within the community of God's people. And so she says, someone's coming. I know someone's coming. That'll be the case. And he says, I who speak to you am he. Bam. It's so beautiful, isn't it? That's what happened for you, wasn't it, when Jesus came to you? I'm welcomed and loved and included by the grace of God in Jesus. Well, the disciples come back. They're a bit put out in a way that he's talking, but they don't really know how to raise it with him, you know. So nobody says anything. But the woman, she feels the awkwardness. She doesn't care, though. She leaves her water jug behind. She's not thirsty anymore. She's found living water. And she tears off into town and she finds everybody she can. She tells them, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Not just that he enumerated all my sins for me, but he knew me. He knew what was really going on in me. And so they come out there. Like, this woman would normally have slunk away. She didn't want to be part of the gossip anymore. She didn't hang around, but she comes and talks to them. And they think, well, something's happened here. They come out and they start to hear from Jesus and they believe also. To me, that's really the heart of mission, isn't it? The heart of mission is knowing that we're included in the community of God and of his family, all by grace, and that we've got good news to tell others that they can be there too. Lord be with you.